This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies of the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Kabbalah is a mystical tradition within Judaism. It was an obscure cult for centuries, but in recent years, New Age spirituality seekers began to look into its arcane texts and unique forms of meditation. Madonna, Roseanne, and Britney Spears are some of the celebrities who've attended classes at the trendy Kabbalah Center in Los Angeles. The primary text of Kabbalah is the Zohar, and my guest Daniel Matt has returned to its original Aramaic manuscripts to produce what he believes will be the first truly usable English translation. It's a massive undertaking, expected to take as long as 15 years. The first of what will be 12 volumes was published late last year. Daniel Matt is a professor of Jewish spirituality at Berkeley's Graduate Theological Union. The Zohar appeared at the end of the 13th century. It's a novel that's been described as a spiritual fantasy filled with humor and eroticism. It tells the story of a group of rabbis who wander among the hills of Galilee. Through their adventures and the unlikely characters they encounter, they discover new, radical interpretations of the stories in the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament. Who wrote the Zohar?
That's still something of a mystery. The Zohar first emerged in Spain in the 13th century. The man who made it available was a Jewish mystic, a Kabbalist named Moses de Leon. He claimed that he was copying from an ancient manuscript that went back to the 2nd century, and that the Zohar had been composed in the circle of a famous rabbi, Rabbi Shimon, the son of Yochai. And many people accepted that claim, and it was really because of that ancient heritage that the Zohar was seen really as a canonical text, and that really paved the way for the acceptance of Kabbalah. But modern scholars are fairly agreed that Moses de Leon was himself not just the scribe, but the composer, the author of the Zohar, or at least of much of the Zohar.
Why wouldn't he have claimed authorship rather than attribute it to someone many, many centuries before? Why not get all of the glory that comes with writing such a text?
Yeah, according to one account, his wife actually asked him that. And it's unclear. It may have been that he wanted these teachings to be accepted as traditional. If he had come out and offered some of his radical ideas and just said, you know, I have an idea God is a woman, or I have an idea God needs the human being, some of the radical insights of the Zohar that we'll discuss. If he had come out and just presented these as his own innovations, they may well have been rejected.
You have mentioned that the Zohar embodies a lot of radical reinterpretations of ancient biblical writings, the Torah. What do you mean by that? What's an example?
One example is that the gender of God. Of course, almost all Western religion depicts God in predominantly masculine terms. God is Father in heaven, God is the King, God is the Judge. And the Zohar insists that God is equally male and female. So the feminine presence of God, known in Hebrew as Shekhinah, the immanence of God, that word actually is not an invention of the Kabbalah. You find it in earlier Jewish tradition. But in the Kabbalah, the Shekhinah becomes overtly feminine. So God is now seen as half male and half female, and the human task is to unite these two halves of God, which I would say means to actualize the divine potential in the world. How is that done? Through ethical, spiritual action. So that's one example.
There's a lot of eroticism in the text, isn't there?
It's a very erotic text, and that's probably part of its appeal over the ages. Not only does it describe human eros and human romance, but it depicts God as involved in the masculine-feminine union. And the wedding of God, the union of God, is really one of the main focuses of the Zohar.
Who was God marrying?
God really marries herself, or him and herself. We mentioned there's a masculine half of God and a feminine half of God, and the spiritual task is to wed the two of them, to bring the two together. So, for example, the Sabbath is seen as God's wedding, and that has been popularized in Jewish liturgy in the prayer Lecha Dodi, come, my beloved, to greet the bride. So the bride in the Jewish prayer book is depicted as the Sabbath queen, but on another level, the feminine half of God who is ushered into union with the Holy One, blessed be He, the masculine half of God.
You had another passage which you thought gives us an example of one of these radical retreatments of classical Jewish texts, the Torah.
We all know the story of the Garden of Eden, and of course Genesis says very explicitly that God expelled Adam from the garden. But the Zohar asks here one of its radical questions. It says, who threw whom out of the garden? Did God throw out Adam or not? And that pregnant not actually unfolds in the Zohar. And the Zohar says, really, in a deeper sense, Adam expelled God from the garden. You might say that we're really still in the garden, but we don't realize it because we've lost touch with the divine. We've excluded the spiritual dimension from our life. So the mystical challenge becomes reacquainting ourselves with God, reestablishing an intimacy with the divine.
So it was perhaps Adam that threw God out of the garden.
That's what the Zohar actually says, one of the most radical teachings imaginable. Adam threw God out, or Adam divorced God.
My guest is scholar and writer Daniel Matt. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is scholar and writer Daniel Matt. He's currently engaged in a multi-year project of translating the Zohar. That's the prime text of Kabbalah, the movement of Jewish mysticism. Well, Daniel Matt, let's talk a little bit about how Kabbalah developed. A lot of people are surprised to discover that it was associated with Hasidim, who I think most people would regard as sort of the most traditional of Jews. I mean, those who wear black hats and long beards. How did they interact with the Zohar and with the spread of Kabbalah?
Right. Well, Kabbalah really emerges in the 12th and 13th centuries in Western Europe. Certainly, it has more ancient roots in the Bible itself and in Rabbinic Judaism, where you have different descriptions of direct contact with God, direct experience with the divine. But Kabbalah is a movement within Judaism, is a medieval phenomenon. And at first, it is really confined to relatively small circles. In Spain, where the Zohar is composed, the Zohar was probably read by a very small number of people. Gradually, over the centuries, Kabbalah spreads to wider circles. And Hasidism, which emerges in the 18th century as a mystical revivalist movement in Eastern Europe, Hasidism could really be seen as the popularization of the Kabbalah. In other words, it takes certain ideas from Jewish mysticism and tries to spread them to the masses, tries to build a community based on this mystical theology.
There's been some controversy around the Kabbalist Center, which I guess began in Los Angeles and has spread, which seems to offer life transformation and 10 easy lessons, but maybe doesn't approach the sort of density or richness of the Zohar. How do you regard this presentation of Kabbalah?
I have mixed feelings about it. On the one hand, they certainly have contributed to the spread of Kabbalah and the awareness of Kabbalah on the part of many groups who otherwise would not have encountered it. But there is an inevitable dilution, I think, with popularizing the Kabbalah, and I have to be careful of that in my own work. And, you know, claiming that if you drink certain water that's been rendered holy, or that if you wear a string around your wrist, that this will have a magical effect, I don't think that's really a healthy spirituality for contemporary Americans.
You mentioned the string. Britney Spears, I believe, appeared on the cover of Entertainment Weekly with a sexy outfit and a red string around her left wrist. What is the significance of the string?
This is something that is not really inherently Kabbalistic. It goes back to certain folk lore in Judaism and perhaps in the wider Mediterranean world in which that color would protect you from the evil eye.
And that's sold, I'm told, at the Kabbalist Center for $26, and you can get Kabbalah water for a fee and $415 sets of the Zohar, which I've read are sold more to ward off danger than to study. Does this trouble you?
It certainly does, but I would say, you know, Kabbalah is not one thing. You can find elements of superstition and magic in Kabbalah itself, my approach is really to focus on the gems of Kabbalistic wisdom, the radical reinterpretation of the Bible, and not to indulge in superstitious practices, whether or not they have some basis in certain Kabbalistic traditions.
Well, Daniel Matt, what spurred you to take up this multi-year project of translating this ancient text, the Zohar?
I got a call from a friend of mine, Arthur Green, who said that a family in Chicago, the Pritzker family, was interested in commissioning a new translation of the Zohar. Apparently what had happened was that Margot Pritzker, in this family, began studying with a rabbi in Chicago, a fellow named Yechiel Pupko, prominent Orthodox rabbi in Chicago. They began studying Judaism, and because of Margot's interest in mysticism, they also delved into the Zohar, but they weren't satisfied with the existing English translation. This is a translation done many years ago in England. It's known as the Sansino translation. They were studying this and were frustrated because the Sansino translation is more a paraphrase than an accurate translation. It has no commentary, so the symbolism really remains impenetrable. And either Margot said to Rabbi Pupko or Rabbi Pupko said to her, why don't we commission a new translation? And they approached me and offered this to me, basically. I was overwhelmed. I didn't know what to do. I was very intrigued and very attracted by the possibility, but I knew how intense this would be and was worried that it might be overwhelming. So I took a month off and decided I'd give it a try.
So they were saying essentially, would you please take the next 15 years of your life and translate this massive text?
Yeah, I think that they didn't realize exactly how long it would take, but they certainly knew it would be a major commitment. And they turned to me and offered it to me, basically. So I tried it for this month, and after that month, I decided I'm definitely not doing this. It was just too exhausting. I would work at it 6, 8, 9 hours and be totally drained, get up the next day and try again. And after a month of this, I said, no, this is too much.
Why was it so draining?
The Zohar is written in such a way you often don't know what it means. To make sense of it, you have to meditate on the text. You have to scour dictionaries and reference works, but you also have to meditate within and see how the possible meanings resonate within yourself. So it's a meditative, contemplative undertaking, which is beautiful and fulfilling, but to do it for thousands of pages seemed to me just frightening.
Part of this involved getting the original texts, right? I mean, how did you collect them?
All translations up till now have been based simply on the standard Aramaic edition, and I thought I would do the same. But I had access to original manuscripts of the Zohar. I thought that when I ran across difficult passages, I would check these manuscripts. But after checking them a number of times, I began to discover that the manuscripts often preserved a reading superior to the printed edition. How could this happen? It's really because over the centuries, every scribe who copied the Zohar tried to add a little bit. A scribe would say, oh, this phrase is so difficult, I'll put in a word of explanation. Or sometimes the weird Aramaic would be smoothed away, and a scribe would substitute a more conventional, bland term. So some of the original beauty and lyrical strangeness of the Zohar was lost, and the printed edition really represents a doctored version. So what I decided to do by painstaking analysis was to scrape away hundreds of years of accretion, hundreds of years of scribal addition and doctoring of the text, to try to approach that elusive, hypothetical, original Zohar.
I want to ask you before we go about the Mel Gibson movie, The Passion of Christ. As someone who has spent a lifetime in Judaism and Jewish scholarship, how do you regard the message that it seems to bring?
Well, I would say, first of all, Jesus, of course, strikes people in very different ways. I see Jesus as a Jewish mystic. I see him as a profound Jewish teacher. I don't idolize Jesus. I don't see him as divine or any more divine than any of us could be. But I see him as a profound spiritual teacher. The gospel's presentation of Jesus and of the tragedy of his death does not necessarily reflect the historical reality of Jesus, of Jesus' own lifetime. And I think the problem with the movie is that it assumes that the gospels are totally historically accurate.
What do you see as the reality of the historical Jesus? What are the problems with treating the gospels as history?
You know, it's impossible to know what actually went on in the first century between Jesus and other Jews of his time. We certainly know that Jesus had no intention of starting a new religion, that he wanted simply to live Judaism and to find God through the Jewish faith and to bring other Jews to God. He certainly aroused opposition. Many people may not have been aware who he was or that he was doing anything, but he certainly inspired some Jews and threatened the Romans and certain conservative power structures within Judaism. So it's likely that he was executed by the Romans for rebelling or fomenting rebellion. But the problem is that when the Gospels are written several decades after the event, at that point there is an emerging church, there is rabbinic Judaism, and the Gospels are very hesitant to offend Rome or to blame anything on Rome. So it's convenient for the Gospels to paint a picture as if the Jews were partially or mostly responsible for the crucifixion, that way letting Rome somewhat off the hook. And that later account, which is canonized in the Gospels, is the basis for this film.
Are you concerned about it spreading anti-Semitic messages?
Certainly that is a danger. I would say that the Jews and Christians need to learn from each other's tradition, and perhaps this movie in its own way will encourage and stimulate that. I think Christians need to appreciate the meaning of Torah and all the forms that the Bible has taken in Jewish tradition, how it has unfolded over the centuries. And Jews can come to an appreciation of Jesus, not Jesus as divine, but Jesus as a Jewish teacher.
Well, Daniel, Matt, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Great, thank you.
Scholar and writer Daniel Matt. The first volume of his translation of the Zohar has just been published and was awarded the Koret Jewish Book Award.